IPU On Air, the Interparliamentary Union's podcast.
Welcome to IPU On Air, the Interparliamentary Union's podcast on all things parliaments, parliamentarians, and legislative issues. Today we're live from Geneva at the House of Parliaments on the eve of the Sixth World Conference of Speakers of Parliament. I'm Kate Brooks from the IPU, and I'm thrilled to be your host today for this insightful discussion on the unique role of speakers in legislatures. Today's episode takes us behind the scenes of one of the most pivotal and sometimes misunderstood roles in any legislature, that of the speaker. Joining us is someone who embodies this role with distinction, Dr. Angelo Ferrugia, Speaker of the House of Representatives of Malta and an international figure with deep involvement in parliamentary diplomacy, including his work with the European Union, the OSCE, and right here with the Interparliamentary Union, where he serves as President of the Committee to Promote Respect for International Humanitarian Law. Dr. Ferrugia has had a distinguished career in public service and has been instrumental in numerous parliamentary initiatives. First entering Parliament in 1996, he was re-elected for the third consecutive time as Speaker in 2022. We're speaking today on the sidelines of the Sixth World Conference of Speakers of Parliament, a rare gathering of presiding officers from across the globe, and a perfect moment to explore what it really means to hold the gavel. Dr. Ferrugia, welcome to IPU On Air.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
So let's begin with the core of your duties. Many may think of the Speaker as someone who simply moderates debates, but the role is actually much more complex than that. Can you walk us through your main responsibilities in the chamber?
Yeah, exactly. My responsibility falls also under the Maltese constitution. We have a written constitution where it explains clearly the role of the speaker, which, of course, as you said, he is there to preside, but more than that, not only to have put order at the house, but sometimes also to give directions and also decisions. In fact, while we are doing this interview, I can tell you that since I became speaker in 2030, I published more than 14 books on decisions that I gave, which we call rulings, and which, are, of course, some of them are even quoted in the Commonwealth. As you know, Malta is part of the Commonwealth, and we do discuss also between the speakers of the Commonwealth certain areas where we can have those decisions that we can share as prisoners. And we also, as I said, we also have the standing orders, which standing orders are mainly based on those standing orders of the House of Commons. And when the standing order is silent, that is when in some particular area I don't have a clear direction how I can act or decide, in the standing orders themselves, it is clearly written that I have to refer to the standing orders of the House of Commons or decisions taken by the House of Commons. So we have that procedure which we have to follow. But more than that, I also preside one of the important parliamentary committees, which is a committee where we discuss the agenda, where we discuss the timetable of the parliamentary roadwork. And so there I'm not only I preside, but sometimes I also give my own advice to both the government and the opposition where we sit. I have also a role where I have to chair a very important committee, parliamentary committee, with regards to the behavior of members of parliament, including also members of the executive, because as you know, in order to be a minister or prime minister, you have to be an elected MP. We don't have the cabinet which can be composed of technocrats. So even there, there is a code of ethics which has to be applied both for parliamentarians and for ministers. And that when in the committee the vote is tied, that is there is no clear majority, but it is my role that I have to do the casting vote which I do that, but I motivate my vote. I write in detail why I'm voting yes or no. So this is what, in short, what I chair in my parliament. Of course, I've got my also role in the international level, where we have the, as you know, Malta as part of the European Union. So even there, we have a special committee where we have to follow a certain procedure which we have to adapt with regards to the European Union. So Malta, as member of the European Union, also a Maltese parliament, can either agree or disagree with what is being decided by Brussels. So we can also present our recent opinions in favor or against a certain legislation which is coming up from Brussels. So it's quite complicated, but we do that, of course, on a regular basis.
So that's a lot of responsibilities that you've just mentioned there. I'm particularly interested in how you manage sort of the competing dynamics between the government and the opposition, which is a part of your role. Can you speak a bit to that when in Malta?
I tell you why that I don't have that problem. Because in 2012, I resigned from the party that I used to belong. So I am not conditioned by any party influence. I'm completely independent and neutral. So, of course, you can always be criticized or not. I mean, this is a part of the democracy. But I can assure you that from the great number of decisions that I took or recommendations or reports, I am completely unconditioned with what I decide. So that's something which, in fact, when I discuss and when I share what I do with other speakers, sometimes they tell me, how can you manage that? But anyway, I'm not part of the party.
Okay, so the independence is a strength there. And I guess you must rely on a significant team to help you manage all those different tasks.
Oh, yes. We have a very good staff. One of the things that I did during my tenure as speaker is that I managed to also go for complete parliamentary autonomy, and I drafted with experts the legislation that gave us complete autonomy, which is the Parliamentary Service Act, where you know the staff of parliament feel themselves completely belonging to parliament rather than having difficulty between one party or the other. Yeah.
And can you speak a little bit into any tips or tricks you have in ensuring that all members' rights are upheld in the chamber?
All members are?
Their rights are upheld in the chamber, so the opposition and the government are equally heard. And
oh, yes, of course. In fact, one of the things that I impose is, and there is a parliamentary motion which we have to follow, is that if a member of opposition of government wants to air his views on a particular legislation, motion, resolution, respective of what is being discussed in parliament, he has the right to have the maximum time of 30 minutes, which cannot be cut off before he ends his speech. Of course, he can take less. But 30 minutes as the amount, the time allowed to a government applies also to the opposition. Yeah, that's very important.
So moving on a little bit now, you've already alluded a little bit to the international dimension of your role and talked about the relationship with the Commonwealth.
Yeah.
We're here today in Geneva on the sidelines of the Sixth World Conference, the Speakers of Parliament for the IPU. And one of the significant roles of the Speaker outside the Chamber is serving as a bridge between Parliament and the public and other branches of government, a representation role. You've been active on the international stage, in particular here at the IPU as President of the Committee to Respect International Humanitarian Law. Can you tell us a little bit about that role?
Yeah, that's a very important role, and I'm very pleased that I was elected to chair as president of the International Humanitarian Law Committee. Of course, the committee embraces a very important aspect of our humanity, of the value of we as a human being in the global sea, where there are international conventions where the respect of international humanitarian law has to be respected. And one of the role that I chair, and of course with experts from UN and from the Red Cross, etc., we go into detailed reports about certain areas where there are a lot of displaced persons in Africa, Somalia, and in other countries in Africa, in Gaza, in Ukraine, where we at least will see that, notwithstanding that they are displaced, notwithstanding that you have a lot of refugees in particular areas, the respect of international humanitarian law is being respected. The value, human value are being respected irrespective of the conflict or the war that is ongoing. Now, one of the problems is that although certain countries signed the Geneva Convention and other conventions, we have to see that not only is it signed, but it's also ratified. So that at the domestic level, the enforcement of that particular convention is transmitted and translated into a domestic law in order to see that convention. So you do a lot of work with that, and every period of time we discuss what's happening in particular areas. We are talking about 7 million all over the world of displaced persons. I mean, okay, the most cases that are always in the news at the moment is Gaza and Ukraine, but not only there. In Africa, we have about 6 million and more displaced persons. So yeah, we do a lot of work there.
And as you mentioned, this issue right now is more crucial than ever with the number of refugees and also internally displaced people around the world. As a parliamentarian, what can you do best to contribute to the respect of fundamental humanitarian law during this time of crisis?
Yeah, the role of parliament and in parliament diplomacy is of paramount importance. I mean, if we leave everything in the hands of the executive, of the governments, we are damned to fail, because we have those who respect democracy, those who respect the rule of law, but we also have governments in particular countries across the world, in all the continents, including Latin America and Asia. I'm not only referring to Africa but I'm referring it globally, where we have the regimes where the respect of rule of law is always absent. And this is there where we have to ensure that through the IPU, we transmit all our efforts that the role of parliamentarians and the role of parliament and the role of the speaker chairing parliament has to be upgraded, and we will have all that influence to ensure that the international humanitarian law is being respected. And this is the hard core. But we are doing quite a number of efforts, and I think we are succeeding in particular areas where we have positive results. Recently, I can vouch we had positive results also in Latin America and other areas.
And what do you hope to get out of this week in Geneva, meeting with other speakers at the conference?
Well, I can tell you one of the things that I really want to emphasize is we have a lot. The world at the moment is in a very critical position. We have a lot of questions that are being unanswered. But one of the things that we have to work on is on trust and hope. And I think Pope Francis really had the foresight before he passed away, when he spoke about encouraging hope and making sure that hope will be always present in order to work on peace. And this is something which we have to work together, and I hopefully that in the coming 2 days we will transmit it more strongly in all the, and not only through the conference, but also during the themes that we are going to discuss during this conference, which I will be one of the panelists in Team 5 with regards to addressing the problem of vulnerability of people, wherever they are.
Absolutely. And I should mention that a focus of the conference this week in Geneva is restoring faith in multilateralism. So moving on now to the challenges that you face in your role as speaker, what for you is the biggest challenge that you face in your day-to-day work?
Well, the biggest challenges, they keep coming. They keep coming. I think one of the challenges, however, is that we have to ensure that the people in our respective countries do continue to believe in parliament democracy. One of the things that I get worried a lot is that we have a phenomenon also in my country where the young people are getting much more disinterested in the working of parliament democracy, which when you discuss this with other speakers all over Europe and also across the world, all of them agree that yes, that is their problem. And I think in order to ensure that the future generation of our parliamentary democracy not only keeps itself alive but gets stronger, we have to work on that. And I think this is one of the issues that we have to address.
And this is something when we interview MPs at the IPU, we often hear that keeps them up at night, this fear about the declining faith in democracy and interest and declining interest in our political institutions by the youth as well. What would you say as a message to those people who are losing faith in democracy?
Well, my message is very clear. Even if there is something which is not working, we have to share it and discuss it, and we have to put things straight. One of the things that I'm doing as an example, in order to lead by example, you have to share what you're doing, is we have now a special parliamentary committee between government and opposition in order to revise the parliamentary procedure, whether that parliamentary procedure is being attractive enough for the whole population, and mainly to the young people. One of the things, of course, we gave the right to vote for the 16-year-old. But the fact that you get, and we were one of the first countries in Europe, but the first you do that, you have to prepare also the young people. So the revision of the standing orders is of paramount importance. And of course, this is one of the things that we can do. Of course, there are other areas where we can improve.
That's actually a great segue into my next question, which is that Malta actually has three times the number of MPs under 30 than the global average, which is about 2.7%, and Malta has 10%. What do you think it is that has made Malta successful in encouraging young people?
Yeah, we are fortunate that the participation of the public is very strong. I did say that the young people are losing a little bit of faith, so we can address that. But when it comes to participation of the public, I mean, whenever we have elections, local, national, or international, because as you know, we organize elections also to elect members of parliament from Malta and the European Parliament, the percentage of the participation sometimes is even over 90%. So that is one of the reasons why we have that number. However, if you ask me whether you agree or not with the number of the number of members of parliament, which reflects the percentage which you quote, I think we have quite a number. So that has to be the reason being the Malta and Gozo, the island of Gozo. They are divided into 13 districts, and I think that should shrink to 4 to 5 districts, like Luxembourg or like Cyprus and all that. And I think we have 79 at the moment members, and I think it should go down to 45-50. That is something which I agree, so that the members will be completely focused. And also, they should not be more concerned on the area where they are being elected, but they should be concerned more on at the national level.
Okay.
Yeah, something which we have to address. Yeah.
It's also interesting because my follow-up question, and you've alluded to some already, but is there any, what reforms have you fought for or implemented in Parliament that you're particularly proud of, or what reforms would you like to see take place in the chamber?
One thing which I was happy to see is that, notwithstanding that Malta was one of the first countries in the Commonwealth to introduce the right of to vote of women in 1947, yet the percentage of women being elected in Parliament was also very low, was always very low up to recently. I mean, not more than 12%. And so we had to address the gender quota in Parliament, and now we get that close to 30%, which is not bad. I mean, we should get it even higher. Now, one of the things that we did is that we did a reform in the electoral law, and also we amended the constitution in order to make sure that if less than 40% of the members of parliament are not women, then we have a mechanism that will be applied in order to we have to be elected a quota which has to be respected by both government and opposition, and that's why we had the increase of women parliamentarians in parliament. Now that was a good way how to introduce, but one thing that we have to do is that the main parties, I mean, because in Malta we have two main parties, and I mean those who are in parliament either belong to one party or the other. I mean, the parties now, they have to make sure that they have to encourage more women candidates to candidate themselves during the elections. Now, I would like to see that to happen.
So as you know, this is an area that the IPU works on a lot, sure, getting more women into parliament. And as you said, Malta is around 30%, yeah, where the global average is about 27. So Malta's above, yeah, that. Yeah. Do you believe that the quotas that you've introduced and those initiatives you mentioned have made a real difference to that number?
Yeah, it did make a difference in the last election in 2022. And in fact, we have also quite a number of women in the cabinet. So they are elected and they are also now ministers or junior ministers. We have also, for example, the president of the European Parliament, she's a woman and she's Maltese, Roberta Metsola. I mean, so, and she was elected by the Maltese during the European Union parliamentary elections. So yeah, we did make quite a number of initiatives and progress, but now the fact that we did that progress, we have to maintain that, and we had not only to maintain that, but to increase more the representation of female in our parliament. And we are fortunate that we have one camera. I mean, I'm not saying anything against those who have two cameras. But as you know, Malta, when you go through the efficiency of the our Maltese parliament, it's one of the highest efficient parliament in Europe. I mean, the clearance rate is very strong, and the participation of women is very strong also.
Interesting. So I'm going to finish up by asking a question that we often ask MPs. As a speaker, as a parliamentarian, as someone working a lot on the international stage, what gives you hope and what keeps you up at night?
At night? I tell you, sometimes I don't really sleep well. When something, because I don't know if you follow clearly the Maltese politics. I mean, they are passionate. We are Mediterranean, and sometimes when there is an issue in parliament and one of the parliamentarians or a group of parliamentarians, they ask the speaker, they ask me, to give a clear ruling about particular procedure. Sometimes I take hours to study the matter, and sometimes I really don't sleep well until I finish the job. But no, it's something that I am one of the speakers in the history of Parliament in Malta where I'm completely focused on Parliament. In fact, I used to be a very practicing lawyer before I became speaker, and I renounced all my professional work, and I completely focused on parliament. And that that gave me a lot of satisfaction to do a lot of reforms, which I did. And of course, there are other areas which I need to do, and hopefully I will do during my tenure as Speaker of Parliament.
And what in the world gives you hope for the future?
Well, what I say is I leave it to the Almighty, whatever is ready for me. But I'm sure that I can always be ready to do whatever is needed in the national interest and in the interest of the constitution of the country.
Dr. Farija, thank you for joining us on IPU On Air. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Pleasure to visit you.
And to our listeners, if you'd like to learn more about the role of parliaments and the role of MPs, you can check out our website at ipu.org or follow us on social media. Thank you so much for listening today.